Welcome back, friends. Welcome back to another edition of Questions for Corbett. I'm your host, James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, coming to you, as always, from the sunny climes of Western Japan here in October of 2025. And today we're going to take our question from the mailbox, specifically from an email that was recently delivered to the contact form at CorbettReport.com by Robert, who writes, regarding the U.S. Congress interior design history, "Hello, James. Wondered if you knew the story behind the two decorations behind the Speaker's chair in the U.S. Congress chamber. They look like bunches of sticks. Wonder who designed them, etc. Regards, Robert." All right, thank you for the question, Robert. I can't help but question the sincerity of this question. It seems like maybe you know something about this symbol. Maybe you have heard of it before. Well, let's not assume anything. I don't want to make an ass of you or me, so let's actually delve into this, because although some people might know some of the basics behind this question, studying it in its particulars brings out some interesting facts. Specifically, what am I referring to? Of course, I'm referring to the, as Robert correctly points out, the bunches of sticks that are behind the Speaker's chair in the U.S. Congress chamber. What are those symbols? Well, anyone who was around in, say, the early 2000s conspiracy culture, which was where I first cut my teeth on the subject, will remember those videos that were abounding at the time about the various Illuminati Freemasonry symbolism in Washington and elsewhere. Generally just slideshows, essentially, with some groovy music. And I would love to show you one of those compilations, but unfortunately, the vicissitudes of the internet in our modern age make it such that those videos are now basically unsearchable, and even if they do exist, which I'm sure they probably still do in some hidey hole in some corner of the internet, you can't access them anymore. So I think we'll just have to make do with this. This is a whale.2, which I am sure, again, will be familiar to people who were there, say, 20, 25 years ago, cutting their teeth on conspiracy realist internet research at that time. It has a lot of interesting links and articles to a lot of different things, and this is their article on fascies. So it notes helpfully at the very top here that fascism is derived from the Latin fascies, and it goes on to say, "Do you know what a fasci is? A fasci is the symbol from which we get the word fascism. It was a symbol used widely in the Roman Empire, and it consists of rods bound together around an axe. The axe is the origin of the term Axis powers for the fascist countries in the Second World War." Really? Citation needed. "The symbolism is of people and countries bound together under a common centralized dictatorship, the axe. Not only was this used by ancient Rome back in the day as one of its symbols of supreme authority, but also by the original Axis powers of Europe back in the first half of the 20th century, prior to and during World War II. Numerous governments and other authorities have used the image of the fasces as a symbol of power since the end of the Roman Empire. It has also been used to harken back to the Roman Republic, particularly by those who see themselves as modern-day successors to the old Republic. Whenever you see a fasci with a laurel wreath wrapped around it, it signifies that the government using it was freely given absolute reign by the people, and that the people recognize and submit to its supreme authority over everyone and everything." Wow, okay, so, and here are some examples. The Knights of Columbus symbol, the Mussolini revived, harking back to the Roman Republic symbol, and its various implementations, for example, on the Italian fascist, National Fascist Party flag, etc., on various postage stamps and other things that were in Italy at the time. U.S. government symbols, for example, of course, the Lincoln Memorial. What has he got his hands resting on? It's those bundles of sticks again, or, as was originally pointed out, the U.S. Congress, the Speaker's chair. Behind the Speaker's chair, there's the two fascies there with the axe on top. It's on the dime. It's on the administrative office of the United States court seal. It's on the seal of the state of Colorado, right under the all-seeing eye of Horus. Again, just a normal American symbol, guys. Just deal with it. Yeah, it's related to the mace that is wielded by the sergeant in at arms in the speaker's next to the speaker at the house. There's the symbol of the U.S. Senate, etc. So, yes, this fascist symbol gets around and is in many places in many countries, not just the United States, obviously, not even just Italy, but elsewhere besides. And so it does have some interesting history, and this summary here is, I guess, well, it is a summary, but I don't know. It certainly doesn't have any citations, and its accuracy and veracity should not be taken at face value. So if you want to get more into the weeds of the research of this symbol, the fascis, and what it really represents, well, you could turn to an entire book that was recently penned on the subject, The Fascis, A History of Ancient Rome's Most Dangerous Political Symbol by T. Corey Brennan. And although I cannot vouch for this book because I have not read it all, I have read the handy-dandy preview chapters that are available online, and it is definitely a in-depth and scholarly treatise on the fasci, the symbol, where it came from, how it developed, how it was used over the years from even pre-Roman Republic times to the present. But long story short, if you need it, the Washington Post has this article up about that book. A new book explores the fasces, a symbol of power and of unity, which talks about the appearance of this symbol in Washington, D.C. For example, the Founding Fathers took inspiration from Greek and Roman tropes, political, cultural, artistic. As a result, Washington bristles with fasces. The Lincoln Memorial alone is full of them, not just on Abraham Lincoln's chair, but carved in multiple places on the monument's walls and depicted in its murals. Washington is a bonanza for fasces spotting, Brennan said. Brennan, the author of the book, obviously. It's hard to see any federal building from the New Deal period that doesn't have the fasces in some place. Ah, the New Deal period. That's an interesting tidbit that we'll have to explore in more depth. He goes on to talk about how it was originally not only the symbol, but actually the actual weapon that was carried by the lictor, a Roman official who served as a sort of bodyguard to elected magistrates. The fasces is essentially a mobile kit for punishment. It consisted of a bunch of sticks to beat someone with and an axe to cut off his head, which is what the lictors did when they were compelled to do so. And they were seen as brutish, low-born thugs, and they were not looked upon kindly, even in Roman times. The fasces was an instrument of terror that was meant to induce fear. And thus it was picked up on in the 1920s by Benito Mussolini, who formed his National Fascist Party. When he formed the party, he chose this ancient Roman tool, well, Etruscan originally, as the party's namesake and original. Symbols can mutate over time, and so it was with the fascis. You see, yes, there's a lot of, you know, ignoble history behind the fascis, but we're talking about the pure, noble U.S. fascis here. By the time the U.S. was erecting and decorating its state houses, courthouses, post offices, and bridges, the fascis had taken on a distinctly American personality. Rather than represent an enforcer, it came to represent unity. Oh, good. Well, that's what we want, guys. It's all about unity. And so it wasn't 12 sticks bundled together, it was 13 to represent the 13 original states. Well, there you go. It goes on to say that unlike the swastika, the fascis remain obscure in America. Well, evidently, if Robert's question is to be taken at face value, where it is a generic symbol of unity and good governance. There is nothing fascist about the fascis in Daniel Chester French's statue of a seated Lincoln in his memorial, dedicated in Washington, D.C. on May 20th, 1922, 7 months before Mussolini's march on Rome, by which he seized political power in Italy. Wearing a t-shirt emblazoned with a fascis to a hate rally in 2022 is a different matter. So there you go, guys. There are good fascis and bad fascis, and they have different symbols and different meanings, and they don't necessarily mean fascism, so don't worry about it. Don't worry your pretty little heads. Well, maybe we can get an alternate opinion on that, because I think there is a bit more to this story than we are getting, in, at least in that tidbit from Washington Post. Again, maybe the more to the story can be found in the book itself, but let's go to this article that was posted up at City Journal over a decade ago, by Eugene Kontrovich, When Fascis Aren't Fascist, which goes on obviously to make a point, but I think it raises a few interesting points along the way. It starts by noting that more than 60 years ago, George Orwell observed that the word fascism had been so widely used as a political epithet that it had lost all meaning. That remains true today, as partisans across the political spectrum still enjoy using the term, mostly in a figurative sense, to excoriate their opposition. Well, This was written over a decade ago. I'm sure it has only gotten orders of magnitude worse since then. How much have we seen that word fascism being brandished as a cudgel over the past decade? Quite a bit, actually. Oh, to go back to 2014, the heady bygone days of relative national unity and accord, right? Well, as this article goes on to say, like the lamp in the scales, they, the fascists, represented a particular attribute of the classical view of justice: physical power, or the ability to impose order. And we already had a taste of that from the previous article. Obviously, we know these were literal weapons that were carried by the lictors to literally enforce the will of the Roman magistrates. So, yes, they are symbols of power, and have been for thousands of years at this point. It does go on to state that when he came to power in Italy in 1922, Mussolini resurrected the symbol and employed it to represent the strength and unity of the Italian state. Political fascism made physical power and the ability to impose order central to its ideology, and so the term fascism quickly became synonymous with authoritarian regimes, which is essentially basically the way that most people use that term these days, especially when it is used as the pejorative for your political opponent. When you call them a fascist, you basically mean authoritarian, tyrant, something like that. It doesn't have a lot of meat on the bones at this point as a political ideology, at least not in the minds of the general public. More examples: the Arlington Memorial Bridge, etc. And then it goes on to talk about the specific connection. So did these symbols just spontaneously arise both in Italy and America at about the same time for no particular reason, or was there a particular reason? Well, as this article goes on to note, then in charge of federal building programs, the Treasury Department directed the Federal Triangle Office Construction Project. Andrew Mellon, who served as Treasury Secretary until 1932, personally oversaw much of the planning and design for it. He was an early and durable Mussolini fan who, among other things, helped the Italian regime secure favorable terms for its World War I debt. Mellon urged that Italian economic policies be imported into the New Deal. So here we go. We're finally getting an actual, real historical linkage and connection with a real name of Andrew Mellon connecting the Italian Mussolini fascist regime to the American FDR New Deal, right? And it does go on to elaborate on that in some detail, so I will commend this article to your attention. But I think that's, at the very least, we're starting to get that sense. Oh, maybe there is a connection here, and maybe it's more significant than what other sources might let on. But, as it points out, essentially fascist these days is just a linguistic weapon to be wielded against your opponent. You're a fascist, you're a tyrant, you're an authoritarian. It's just a word to be bandied about. So let's see if we can find out what is fascism, politically speaking, as a political ideology. What is fascism? Well, why take it from me or anyone else? Why not take it straight from Il Duce's mouth? And of course, we'll go to that wonderful source of information online, izquotes.com, for the infamous quotation that we've all heard and has been mouthed many times in the independent media and elsewhere, where Mussolini said, quote, fascism should more appropriately be called corporatism because it is a merger of state and corporate power, end quote. There you go, guys. Done and dusted. Here it is. Fascism, corporatism, merger of state and corporate power. Done. Right? There's your definition. One little problem with this quotation, like every other big quotable quotation that you can name from pretty much every a major historical figure in history, this one too is made up. Specifically, if you go to Mussolini on the Corporate State for Political Research Associates, they note that although this is generally attributed to an article written by Mussolini in the 1932 Encyclopedia Italiana with the assistance of Giovanni Gentile, the editor, the quote does not appear in the Encyclopedia Italiana in the original Italian. It does not appear in the official English translation of that article called The Doctrine of Fascism, and it does not appear in the longer treatment of the subject by Mussolini in Fascism, Doctrine, and Institutions. Where the quote comes from remains a mystery. No one's ever been able to track it down. And, in this 2005 article, they do have a very enticing offer for you. If you can find a source for the quote based on an actual original document that you copy and mail to them, they will sign you up for a free 3-year subscription to the Public Eye magazine. Remember when things were based on mailing things in the mail and print magazines and things? That was only 2 decades ago, if you can believe it. Anyway, the point is, this is not a real quote, and we should probably stop bandying it about as if it were real. So why not we actually go to what was actually written about fascism, specifically that aforementioned 1932 Encyclopedia Italiana article that was penned by Benito Mussolini and maybe a little bit of ghostwriting, or an awful lot of ghostwriting by Giovanni Gentile. And as this explains, this article, co-written by Giovanni Gentile, is considered the most complete articulation of Mussolini's political views. This is the only complete official translation we know of on the web, copied directly from an official fascist government publication of 1935, Fascism, Doctrine, and Institutions. This translation includes all the footnotes from the original. Blah, blah, blah. Okay, so the doctrine of fascism. Well, you won't believe what the doctrine of fascism actually says. Oh, maybe you will. So, for example, we have this. Anti-individualistic, the fascistic conception of life, stresses the importance of the state and accepts the individual only insofar as his interests coincide with those of the state, which stands for the conscience and the universal will of man as a historic entity. It is opposed to classical liberalism, which arose as a reaction to absolutism and exhausted its historical function when the state became the expression of the conscience and will of the people. Liberalism denied the state in the name of the individual. Fascism reasserts the rights of the state as expressing the real essence of the individual. And if liberty is to be the attribute of living men, sorry, there is some bad OCR going on in this document, but I'll persist. And if liberty is to be the attribute of living men and not of abstract dummies invented by individualistic liberalism, then fascism stands for liberty. And for the only liberty worth having, the liberty of the state and of the individual within the state. So, yes, the state uber alles, essentially, or whatever the Italian equivalent of such a term would be. So, he goes on to talk about things that I think should resonate, probably, with Americans in the crowd, because it does sound interestingly familiar to people who are familiar with American political rhetoric. For example, he says fascism is, the fascist state is not a race, nor a geographically defined region, but a people historically perpetuating itself, a multitude unified by an idea and imbued with the will to live, the will to power, self-consciousness, personality. Which, to my mind, I don't know, I only ever grew up with the secondhand propaganda that made its way across the border into Canada, but all the American rhetoric I ever heard was about how America is not just a country, it's an idea. It's the idea of human liberty, and that's what makes it. It's not about a race, it's not about a nation state geographically bound, it's about the idea of liberty. Blah, blah, blah. Well, here it is. And, oh, by the way, liberty means liberty of the state, and maybe of individuals within the state, only so far as they suborn themselves to the state. He goes on in much more detail. The fascist state, as a higher and more powerful expression of personality, is a force, but a spiritual one. It sums up all the manifestations of the moral and intellectual life of man. Its functions cannot therefore be limited to those of enforcing order and keeping the peace, as the liberal doctrine had it. It is no mere mechanical device for defining the sphere within which the individual may duly exercise his supposed rights. The fascist state is an inwardly accepted standard and rule of conduct, a discipline of the whole person. It permeates the will no less than the intellect. It stands for a principle which becomes the central motive of man as a member of civilized society, sinking deep down into his personality. It dwells in the heart of the man of action, and of the thinker, of the artist, and of the man of science, etc., etc. It goes on and on in like manner for many, many, many pages here. And I do invite you to go and read through it all, because I think there are, again, some interesting passages that do further flesh out this idea. What is the actual political ideology, to the extent that a real thought-out ideology exists behind fascism? Well, here it is, in the words of the man himself. We are, in other words, a state which controls all forces acting in nature. We control political forces. We control moral forces. We control economic forces. Therefore, we are a full-blown corporative state. We stand for a new principle in the world. We stand for sheer, categorical, definitive antithesis to the world of democracy, plutocracy, Freemasonry, to the world which still abides by the fundamental principles laid down in 1789. Indeed. So fascism is explicitly, in its own founding document, explicitly directed as a dagger at the heart of that silly freedom of the individual in that was laid down in 1789. Oh, who cares about that? So it's explicitly against the entire American project. But then you had Andrew Millen and others wholeheartedly embracing Mussolini and the fascists and trying to bring the literal symbolism of fascism to the shores of the U.S. Interesting. Interesting, is it not, at the very least, to know about these historical linkages? And I, again, would suggest that you go and read through this document if you are interested in what fascism actually is. But as I say, I think this should be vaguely reminiscent to people in the audience, specifically to Americans who are probably used to hearing about how the state is the ultimate authority over everything, and individuals with their pesky individual rights are only valid insofar as they are subordinate to the all-ruling, absolute, glorious state.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
There is little cultural overlap between violent extremists abroad and violent extremists at home. But in their disdainful pluralism, in their disregard for human life, in their determination to defile national symbols, they are children of the same foul spirit, and it is our continuing duty to confront them.
If you remain unvaccinated, your life will be hell in America. You're not going to be able to do much.
But I think people should know there's a virus here. It kills people. And the only way we prevent it is to get vaccinated, to wear masks, to do social distancing, washing your hands all the time, and not just to think about, well, my freedom is being kind of disturbed here. No, screw your freedom.
What the executive order does, sir, it charges your Department of Justice with investigating instances of flag burning. And then where there's evidence of criminal activity, that where prosecution wouldn't fall afoul of the First Amendment, and instructs the Department of Justice to prosecute those who are engaged in these instances of flag burning.
And what the penalty is going to be, if you burn a flag, you get 1 year in jail.
Oh, I hope the hearts of every red-blooded American man and woman in the crowd is stirring at such wonderful and uplifting words. And I hope you're definitely not getting any thought of burning any American flags in your head, because that's 1 year in jail, because we have taken away freedom of speech, as Trump bragged later in that very same press conference. Yay, wonderful. Well, anyway, make of all that what you will. I think that there is a bit of a connection there between the underlying core principles of fascism and the all seeing, all-knowing, the spiritual fulfillment of man in the state, and statements and sentiments like that. But I'm sure some would argue, oh, it's different in those mouths and said in that context. And there is no doubt much more that should be explored in a thoroughgoing deep dive examination into this concept of the fascies and fascism and what it means and where it comes from. I mean, for example, we could pick up from that word, corporative state, or those words, from that Italian Mussolini-penned or co-penned article about fascism. And we could point out that even that, although, again, our modern 21st century sensibility would, and in English, would probably interpret that as being about corporations or something in a straightforward sense, but it is... That is not, I am given to understand, although I do not read Italian myself, that it is embedded in a much more complex linguistic framework that has to do with the corporazione, which were guilds, essentially, that were set up under fascism that operated differently than corporations, which were società. Again, I don't speak Italian myself, but there's a lot more going on underneath the surface of those words, so there needs to be more exploration of that. And yes, although... Again, as we have seen, there were actual literal fans of Mussolini who were deliberately bringing the fascist symbols to the shores of America, or at least proliferating the number of fascists in Washington in the New Deal times. Still, no doubt that the original American interest in the fascists as a symbol of power and of unity were no doubt influenced by Aesop's fables, and specifically a fable that was popularized in the in the Renaissance times, I believe, about the father, his sons, and the bundle of sticks. And the moral of that particular fable is essentially, well, strength through unity. Individual sticks can be broken easily, but together they cannot be broken. That kind of thing. And that is, of course, the where we get that strain of political rhetoric from e pluribus unum to all of the other things about a house divided cannot stand and all of that. It's the same idea eventually, essentially, which is that we are all part of one great nation and we all must work together and blah, blah, blah. That kind of feel-good political rhetoric about unity and strength through unity, rather than the we will cut off your head if you disagree symbol of power that the fascists were, for example, in ancient Roman times. Although, in the end, it's kind of the same thing, of course, because always at the end of every statist argument is the implied threat of, and if you don't, we'll come and throw you in a cage. And if you resist being thrown in a cage, we'll kill you. So it does ultimately end at the same place, but it starts with much more inspiring and rousing rhetoric. The lictors carrying the fasces in ancient Rome were known as thugs and were derided by the populace, but the politicians standing in front of the fasces in the U.S. House, I mean, those are good, upstanding people that are looking out for our interests. Right? Interesting. Well, anyway, long story short, yes, this is the history of the fascists and how they have become a very powerful political symbol that continue to be used to this very day. I think there is more to be said about it than is often said in trite articles about, yeah, there's fascists all over Washington, but relax, guys, it doesn't mean much. No, it does mean something, because, again, the very founding principles of fascism, the very founding idea, is all about collectivism and subordinating the individual to the collective. There is no this silly liberalism and their silly idea about individual rights. Ah, that's stupid. The state is the only thing that matters. And if you don't believe me, again, go read that Mussolini piece in its full context, and you can, if your eyes don't glaze over, you can read all about how the state is the, not just the present, it's the past and the future, and everything is embodied in this, and blah, blah, blah. It just goes on and on about the wonders of the state. And I don't know about you, but personally, I think that makes me very squarely and very unashamedly an anti-fascist. And I know declaring myself as such in the current political climate, at least if I were in the United States, which I am not, but if I were, I guess that would get me added to some sort of terror watch list these days. Oh, he says he's anti-fascist. Well, we know what that means, right? Again, this language becomes weaponized and politicized in ways that are largely divorced from what these terms actually mean. But such is the wonders of language and the way that it changes over time. So anyway, Robert, that's probably a deeper dive into that seemingly simple question than you wanted. Unless that was the point of your asking that question, in which case I guess you got what you wanted. Anyway, lots of links in the show notes, as always, to avail yourself of these resources to go and start this exploration in greater detail on your own time. But I think that's going to do it for this edition of Questions for Corbett. I'm James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, thanking you for investing your time in this exploration, and looking forward to talking to you again in the near future.
The Deep State. False flags. 9/11 truth. The Federal Reserve. Secret wars and hidden histories. Fake news. Medical martial law. Ceaseless propaganda. James Corbett. Reportage. Essays on the New World Order. Available where books are sold. Until they're not.
ReportageBook.com.